I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. At Lighthouse, we're celebrating, we're just talking about acquisitions, but we are not selling. We're celebrating 25 years in business and just entering our 12th year of doing open line programs. We have a few new exciting changes. First, we have our new 2019 open line format that comes with the launching of our new website. You can also find an archive of past topics on our publication event tab. And since we've been doing this so long, whatever topic you're thinking of, we probably have it as far as a publication or an open line program that we've done. Our third book, Cracking the High Performance Team Code, is now available, and we also offer skills testing, which has been a huge hit with our clients. Our topic today is working with your team and planning for the future. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services. I'll be hosting our program today. We have a few housekeeping items, and we're going to jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the very first time at Lighthouse, everything goes back to our mission statement, bringing effective insight to your organization. We do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments to raise the hiring bar and assist companies with a variety of services, including skills testing, stress management workshops, and much more. We also have an office in Taiwan and the UK, so if you have an operation in Asia or in Europe and would like to get leadership coaching for them or providing ideas of how to interact with a US-based company, just let us know. Our open line series is always in response to the number of calls that we get from many of our clients, both domestically and globally, to address the various business issues that organizations are facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program. So on your screen, you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas during our discussion, and we'll attempt to respond to as many of you as possible. So please join us with your thoughts and insights along the way. At the conclusion of our program, we're going to open up the line if we have time, and you can talk directly with Steve. So either way, submit during our program or write some things down for afterwards. I'm taking great pleasure in introducing a very close and longtime friend and colleague, Steve Phillips. Steve has a unique method in preparing teams for the future and specializes in offsites for senior leadership. Some of his clients include Microsoft, PepsiCo, Viacom, Mattel, and Boeing, as well as many smaller companies looking to develop their senior leadership team and to grow. He's the author of many books, including the Team Building Sourcebook, Team Building for the Future, Beyond Basics, and Team Training, From Startups to High Performance, just to name a few. Steve has also served on the faculties of Purdue University, San Diego State University, Pepperdine, and USC. We'll forgive you on the USC thing. Is that okay?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dana. Yeah. Yeah. I'm also teaching at UCLA these days, so I think we're okay.
Okay, well, that's good. I feel so privileged to have Steve back with us today to help us prepare for today's issues, but maybe even more importantly, for preparing for the future. Also, at the end of our program, we're going to have registration starting for our next month's program, which will be Safety is the Backbone of Every Business. So, Steve, welcome back to OpenLine.
Thank you, Dana. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for everything. Congratulations on all the years of OpenLine and all the years with Lighthouse Consulting. It's fantastic work. Appreciate you having me today. So I guess we're just jumping in. Hey, everybody. So we're going to talk about senior teams, but I'm also happy to answer your questions today. So I really appreciate being here. And if you have some specific questions you'd like me to address, please feel free to type in the box and get it to Dana. He'll interrupt me and ask the questions, and I'm happy to try to address as many things as possible today. So with that, I'd like to just jump in, and we can go flip over to the next slide. I just want to make sure I can see it, Dana. So can we flip over and make sure it's on my screen?
It should be up.
All right, here we go. Got it. Key job of any top team. Okay, everybody. Well, so it's funny because I just came from a long developmental training with 20 presidents that work for a giant conglomerate. We talked an awful lot about their teams and what they need to be doing to take their organizations into the future. And one of the things that we really had an interesting conversation about was the difference between true strategic planning and what I'll call operational planning. What most teams really want to do is kind of get down and dirty, what are our strategic initiatives and how are we going to drive the organization forward within our current plan, and then, of course, how to work together highly effectively. And I think that's very, very important. But at the same time, I think it's the job of any senior team to really think about what are our alternative futures in terms of the organization, which alternative future we think is probably going to come true. So what is our most probable alternative future? And then within that probable alternative future, how do we want to position ourselves to either leapfrog the competition, stay ahead of the game, move up our curve in one way or another, drive profitability, drive cash flow, whatever they're potentially looking for. So I think it's the job of any senior team to see alternative futures, choose the best future, and then once they position themselves in that future, then to set the operating plan to drive forward with key strategic initiatives and metrics, and then dropping it down and pulling out the big rocks, meaning the big projects or goals or programs that they want to get done, and then, of course, driving that down to who's going to do what by when with the appropriate accountability system and metrics. So although senior teams have an awful lot to do, they wear an awful lot of hats, I think thinking about the future and positioning the organization into the future and then inspiring people to go there is a very big piece of their job. Let's go to the next slide.
Oh, Steve, a question came in already. Let's see if I can summarize this. This slide seems to be about the top team doing some sort of strategic planning. What's the best practice for how often a team should get together to plan?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. So thank you for asking that question. And people don't like the answer, so I'm sorry if you guys don't like this answer, but we have seen best practices over and over again that it usually is a planning process that is at least 3 times a year and often 4 times a year. And one of the things that teams do that are really stepping up into that 95th percentile of best practice is that they use their strategy and or planning meetings just for planning. It is so often just an agenda item on their normal weekly or monthly or quarterly staff meetings. But really, the best practice I've seen is sometime in the fourth quarter, you have a long planning meeting. And what that does is you end up with a closing out or projecting the close out of the year and then planning for the next year. And then somewhere at the end of the first quarter and the second quarter and the third quarter, they have either half-day meetings specifically to check in on the plans and adjust them, or they might want to add to that some team development or some educational opportunities, and so that might pull into a full day. So 3 to 4 times a year for just planning purposes. And also, just to take a little bit more on that, and I think we're going to get to it in a little while, the accountability system, the reason you want to do 3 or 4 times a year is because the meetings themselves become the accountability system. People have to update the plans before the meetings, and so we're not updating in the meetings. And then in the meetings, the team learns how to speed themselves up, how to work together, how to solve problems. So the meetings themselves are never boring. They're not updates. That is kind of boring. Everybody updates before the meeting. Everybody reads everybody's updates. And then at the meeting itself, you get the team to move faster. You also can adjust the plan and develop the team at that place, because sometimes teams get out of whack and roles get unclear and people have trust issues and so on and so forth. So it's a good opportunity to clean up any of that and keep the team operating at high performance. The last thing with that is, the last thing you really want to do is have the leader of the team chasing people for accountability. So you want to build that system of accountability so that people are naturally held accountable by the fact that they're going to have to present out in public, that everybody is going to see their results. And that way the leader of the team does not have to chase people down, ask them to get their jobs done, deal with all the excuses and so forth. So sorry to take everybody off on that, but I love the questions, so please keep them coming. And also, I will be talking mostly about top teams, senior teams, but I'm happy to talk about any team. So So I love teams. It's my passion in my life, and I'm so happy to be doing the work that I love every day. Okay, so key job of any team, and this is now more important than ever, especially with the millennials in the marketplace, the millennials in the workplace, is knowing the team purpose. So a lot of times teams get put into place and they're just a natural work group. They're just a boss and direct reports, and they're treated from an old paradigm of traditional command and control. But really, teams should have a very solid purpose. What is their reason for being? Where is the value that they're adding? A lot of teams lose their way over time, and they just become people that are kind of trying to get the work done, which is fine, but why are we trying to get the work done, and what is the specific value of our particular team? And then the other thing that I think is important in this, the job of a team, is the relationship building. I deal with a lot of clients that are very much task-driven, and they're just trying to get the job done, trying to make things happen, really being held accountable to their numbers and so forth. And they forget about the emotional intelligence of people. They forget about the relationships that are built on the team. And those relationships are often what will cause the team to go sideways. So the care and feeding of team relationships is just as important as the care and feeding of getting the work done, because we're most of the time getting the work done through the relationships. And then I also find that natural work teams versus a temporary problem-solving team or a task team of some sort, they forget that they can be held accountable to outcomes. And so instead of just getting the daily jobs done, they should think about why they're doing the jobs, how they will know if those jobs are successful, and then put metrics in place. And that's when the meetings 3 or 4 times a year come into play in a significant way, because you can track against your metrics. It's also very funny for me when I travel over time with teams. They're not very good at putting their metrics in place. They haven't really thought really long and hard about them. Sometimes there's too many. Sometimes they're the wrong metrics and so forth. But the real thing for me is how much they are accurate in their predictions. So if you're within 10% plus or minus, that's pretty good. You know, I don't have any problem with that. But when teams start missing their metrics by 30% or more, then it's a real issue, because now the metrics don't mean anything and the team does not have any planning prowess. And what I find is, to do planning well, you've got to keep improving. You've got to get better and better and better at it. You've got to think about planning as something you always need to improve. And that's why tracking can be very, very helpful as well, to see how good we are at tracking. One of my clients right now, a CEO, is embarrassed every time he goes to the board because their forecasts have been off by 30% every time. And he's finding that his sales department does not have the right competency set to forecast well. They don't have the right systems to forecast well. And quite frankly, he's not doing his job getting out and talking to customers enough. And that's very embarrassing for him. I know the board very well, the private equity group that owns them. We're going to be probably bringing in somebody to help them forecast better and get their planning processes down. So it's just a matter of constantly improving, watching those things, and trying to get the right things in place. All right, so let's go to the next slide, please. So getting the right people on the team and getting the wrong people off, this is a very big deal. This is where people make mistakes all the time, especially when you inherit a team. You might get people that have been with your organization a long time. You might have friends. You might have relationships. But you really want A players on your team. A players are not easy to come by. And the more A players you can get, the geometric improvement you get in performance. And it's not that hard when you really try to design the jobs right and find the people right. I'm sure Lighthouse can help you with that for sure. But the biggest problem is your B players. Everybody knows when they have a poor performer, and we can move those out pretty quickly. And everybody knows when they have a top performer because, you know, we want to give them more and more work and we love the work they do and they're just a very integral part of the team. But when you have B players or B minus players, this is the hardest time, because you're losing the potential of an A player. You're losing the upside potential. you do have a good person in place, and they are doing a good job, but they could be doing more and seriously helping the team jump into high performance. So it's difficult to move on them, and a lot of people keep them in place way too long. And then you can move that down to C players and say, yeah, maybe we should just move out the C players and we'll keep the Bs. But I find as you move the whole level of the team up, performance jumps off the chart. And so it's one of those things that I had to speak to the Harvard Business School at one point, and I was so nervous, I called up a bunch of my CEO clients and asked them for words of wisdom. I just wanted to be a great speaker that day. And one of the things they said to me is, Steve, it's never too early to fire someone. And I was like, wait, we know better than that. We want to treat humans better than that. And they said, yeah, I know. But basically what they meant was when they have an instinct that somebody's not right, when they have an instinct that somebody's holding the team back, most people will try to save those people, train those people, get those people through their own barriers, get them up to the next level. And it takes an awfully long time. And what the CEO said to me is they usually end up moving those people out anyway. It takes them about a year to get them off the team. And they've suffered tremendously with the performance in that amount of time. And then what happens is once you move them out, everybody else bounces up. People are afraid to move people off a team because they're afraid of the repercussions. But my experience has been if you move a C player or B-minus player or a poor performer off of a team, everybody's very happy and they're more motivated, and the team gets a very big spike in performance in the beginning, and then they stay at much higher performance over time. So getting the right people on, I think one of the sayings is slow to hire, quick to fire. So it takes a long time to find the right people, but we should move quickly when we don't have the right people on the team. Next slide, please.
Steve, a question came in. Can a B player be – it was two-part. Can a B player become an A player, and should the B player be coached?
Okay, it's a great question. Thank you very much for that. That is very common. And, yes, there are times when a B player can become an A player. Yes, yes, yes. And sometimes, no, not at all. Some people are just capped. And they say they can be better, but they just have all kinds of problems that keep getting in their way. And, you know, sometimes I hate to say it, but they just don't have the raw horsepower to get there. Now, can they be coached? Yes, of course. But this falls into the trap of, am I spending a lot of resources and a lot of time to get somebody from a 6 to a 7 or a 7 to an 8 when they never really truly have the potential to get up to 9 or 10? And this is an instinct thing. This is much more art than science. And once you've kind of evaluated a lot of people, then you kind of have a sense for it. And Dana and everybody, I really wish I could give you a really solid answer to that. I coach as many people as the rest of us, and I got to tell you, sometimes I just can't break people through. We do a lot of coaching. They get incrementally better, but they don't break through to the next level. And I am not sure what the secret sauce is to either assess if they're able to or to get the right coaching for those people or if it's better to just move them into a different position and or restructure so that we don't need them in that particular team. So I wish I had a really solid answer for that. It's a great question. I do coach a lot of people. I coach COOs up into presidents and presidents up into CEOs. I used to coach a lot of people in the middle of the organization, and I'm just finding now the best people to coach are your highest potential people, not the people with problems. It's the good human thing to try to get people to be better in performance. I just haven't seen it. I've been doing it for I've been coaching maybe for 25 years at this point, been in my career for close to 40, and I'm just not seeing everybody capable of getting to be an A player. And I think it's a real difficult judgment call. And if I go back to the advice I was given, if you're solid with people and you think you really know people and you have the instinct that they just aren't going to get there, you might want to coach them to protect yourself if you're going to move them out of their jobs and do everything you can to help them. And from a humanistic point of view, I think it's very important to give people chances and to get them help. But from a high-performance point of view, better to move on them quickly if your instincts say they're not going to make it. So thank you for that question. Keep them coming. I like it.
Okay,
so clarifying roles. So roles are, you know, very clear. I hate doing role clarification on teams because it's kind of boring, actually. But if the roles aren't right, then we got to get them clear. And what I find in most smaller companies is that they've ended up designing jobs around people. So we've got somebody who's telling me who's good at a bunch of things, so we give them those things. We've got somebody else who's not good at a bunch of things, so we kind of take those away. And we end up morphing the roles around people, which is a classic entrepreneurial mistake. It's done in a lot of companies that don't have a lot of resources. They're bootstrapping in a lot of ways. Everybody's got to do everything. But the best of all worlds is not to design your organizational structure or your team roles around people. It's better to design the team roles around what needs to get done in the best way possible so the roles overlap in just the right way, and then you assign people to those roles. And they often need to adapt or we need to move them out. But designing the roles around the people is just something you really is not a good idea. There's no scalability in that. It doesn't build the machine you need to build to move your company forward. But if you are going to clarify roles, then you kind of say, what is everybody doing? Who's accountable for what? What does everybody need from everybody else to do their jobs effectively? And what do others need from them? And it's a pretty simple process if you think roles are an issue. A lot of people will see communication problems and they'll think that they diagnose their problem as, oh, well, our team has a communication problem. But really, when you start peeling the onion on that, the roles just either have too much overlap and people are in conflict, or there's too much distance between the roles and things fall through the cracks. So the model of teams that I tend to use, one of the variables is roles. So it's roles, goals, relationships, processes and procedures, and leadership. So if the roles aren't right, the team is just going to take a pretty high hit when it comes to its overall performance. Let's go to the next slide, please. So get to know your team members and proactively work to build trust. Trust is, I don't want to say it's the currency by which relationships flow, but it is very, very important. And I've now had the experience where I've had three different levels of trust issues. I've had very severe distrust where people thought the boss had a target on their back, people were rebelling against the boss, the team was pulling together in opposition to what the boss wanted. There was all kinds of reasons for the severe distrust. That's very different than just not having trust. If we don't have trust, then we need to work to build trust. And I suggest that we actually should proactively build that trust. And then the last one, and I'll come back to the proactively build, but the last one is when there is a little bit of distrust, is that some people have done some things that maybe been misunderstood. Maybe there has been some actual, kind of negative backbiting or competition in some ways where people are learning not to trust each other. Those things can be cleaned up and you can move forward pretty easily. But I'm in the camp of jump-starting teams to high performance. And when you want to get a team up to high performance, you don't want to slog through all the effort it takes. It's like a boat, kind of pushing a lot of water before it gets up to a plane. I like to just jump the boat right up to a plane. It takes very little energy to go fast, and it's very efficient once you're up there. But to get up there, it takes a lot of energy, and you tend to pushing a lot of water. So that's why I suggest that we proactively work to build trust. And it's funny what actually builds trust, because I can usually split the room. It doesn't matter if I have 10 or 12 or 15 people in the room or if I have 1,000 people in the room. There's a question I always ask, and it never ceases to amaze me. The question is, and it's two different options. Are you somebody who trusts people first until they prove untrustworthy, or are you somebody who does not trust people first until they prove trustworthy? And sometimes it's an East Coast, West Coast split, which is kind of fun just to play with. But I'm a trusting soul. I trust people first until they prove untrustworthy. But there are other people that just don't trust people first until they prove themselves trustworthy. And I don't think either one is particularly right or wrong. It's just a difference in approach. So getting to know each other on a deeper level quickly is a great way to build trust. So you can do little things like starter questions at the beginning of your meetings that get under the surface with people and have them talk about things they normally wouldn't talk about. Simple questions like, who was really important in your life early in your life, and what impact did they have on you, and how does that impact you today? It's a very deceptive question. People start talking about their dead parents or their dead grandparents or their mentors that are no longer with us, and then all of a sudden they become vulnerable. And when you become vulnerable, that's when you start to build trust. When you actually risk yourself with others is when you start to build trust with others. But there's a lot of other questions, like fun questions, like tell me something that nobody knows about you. So there's little ways to do that. Then there are other ways to do it by spending time together. Us in the field of consulting, we've known forever that groups that spend more time together, especially outside of work, do better at work. But MIT has come out with a lot of studies in the last few years. They put sensors on people, and they have absolutely found that downtime together as a team is an indicator of team performance. And it's because people start building trust with each other. Now, of course, you can always do a style assessment and kind of talk to the team about it and what we all want and how we all are. And everybody's done those a million times. And Lighthouse has some really good ones, so be sure to use those. But it's getting that dialogue going, talking about each other. And really what you want to do is try to pull it into the vulnerable areas. Brené Brown will tell you all day long that when you start becoming vulnerable with people, your character comes out and you start to be able to build trust that much faster. But trust can be a very tricky thing. So it's one of those things where if you can get ahead of the game and start to build trust, then the team goes further and faster, especially in the hard times.
Steve, so what about if a team has a doubting Thomas and it's just grinding on others, and you've tried all these different things, but then they're good contributors to the organization, but they just always have this cynical side.
Yeah, Dan, I know those guys, those people. They are really big detractors to high performance. You know, this is now you're not talking about an A player. An A player is not grinding on the team and pulling the energy away from a team. So now you've immediately dropped to a B, B minus, or C player. Now, they may be an expert. They may add a lot of value to the organization, but they are not adding value to the high team performance. So this is where this is exactly the type of judgment call I was talking about earlier, where I don't think you're going to change this person. You might be able to get them a coach, and sometimes they will understand that they're just a negative person, and sometimes they'll start to understand their poor behavioral patterns, and sometimes they'll change. But more times than not, you can't change the stripes on a zebra. They are who they are. And so now you have to assess, okay, they might add a lot of value to the organization, but are they in the right role on the team? And you know what? A cynical person can play a beautiful role on a team, because you can have team groupthink on a team. You can have all kinds of things where you need to have a devil's advocate, and you can start to assign that person the role of devil's advocate. And if they have a good sense of humor, and, you know, I have called guys like that, and I'm sorry, it's guys, I've called people like that Eeyore before, but I would never do that to somebody that would be offended by that. But if a team has a lot of trust, and if the person knows that they're the kind of that cynical person and they can take some ribbing about it, I think you can make them into a good team player. But if indeed they're sucking the air out of the team, everybody's frustrated with that person, you know, people are avoiding that person causes the meetings to go longer, much, much longer than they ever should, there is some value there. But there's also holding back of potential to high performance. So I suggest you work with the person, give them really solid feedback, maybe get them a coach really quickly. That behavior either changes immediately or doesn't change at all. So that if somebody asked me to coach somebody like that, I would surround them with the feedback I would see if they wanted to change. If they did want to change, I would help them, and they should be able to change very quickly. And if they didn't want to change or they couldn't change very quickly, I would probably think about if I really wanted to continue to have them on the team.
Thanks, Steve. That's great.
You're welcome. I don't know that all my answers are so popular, but I have seen high-performance teams, and once you start dealing with all that kind of stuff, then that becomes the standard, and the team just thrives. Let's go to the next slide, please. So, as I mentioned before, jump-starting teams to high performance, one of the things that is very, very important is to have an explicit set of team ground rules. And I mean explicit because most people have a mental mindset about what a team is and how to operate on a team. But those mental mindsets can be very, very different. So if I were to ask all of you to think of a dog, actually get a dog in your head that has a name, and you can do this exercise with your teams. And then I would go around and say, okay, what kind of dog is it that you're picturing or that you have in mind? And we would have everything from a Chihuahua to a retriever to a shepherd to a Great Dane to a St. Bernard. And those dogs are very, very different dogs. And the care and feeding of those dogs would be very, very different as well. And that's what it's like with teams. When you say teams to people, they get an image in their head, but it could be very different than the other images that other team members have. And so the care and feeding of that team might be implicitly different depending upon the image you have in your head. So I like to talk about the team and make it very explicit. And then setting all the ground rules, the first set of ground rules that a team will usually come up with are in opposition to bad behavior. It's like we want to start our meetings on time and end on time. We want to be efficient with our communication. We want to deal with conflict directly and things like that. And usually that's because the team has been having poor habits or things have not been going well. But the second set of ground rules, say 6 months, 8 months, a year later, can be very aspirational. And so you ask people, what kind of team do you really want to play on? What kind of members do you want, working next to you? You know, how do you want this team to really perform? And people start to get very excited. People like working on high-performance teams, especially your A players. And when your A players are playing with other really high-performance people, then the team just takes off. So I find it's one of those things I do right away on teams is have them set an explicit set of ground rules, like assume best intentions, you know, always come prepared, go directly to the person you have an issue with, stay clean with your team members, things like that. And it really is quite helpful for teams to understand the ground rules or the rules of playing with each other because so often they're implicit and coming from what people just assume is the best way to be. But by talking about it, everybody can reach agreement, and now we have an explicit set of rules to play by, and the team just, it's like having a disciplined process. The team just takes off. It builds freedom, and it allows people to really be themselves, and the team just gets better and better and moves forward quickly. The last bullet on this is high-performance teams talk about what they expect from each other in a safe way, and I think teams talking about themselves as a team is very important. That's when you can do assessments and do different things where say, what kind of team are we? How do we want to be as a team? How effective are we as a team? Many people look at the unit of analysis as the individual team members. It's a psychological approach. What is everybody thinking? What is everybody bringing? I think of the team as the unit of analysis. It's more of a sociological approach. So the team is only as good as the team is. It's not about what individuals are bringing. It's about how the team is performing and what the team needs to perform better. Not what the individuals need, what the team needs. It's a very different way of thinking about teams. And I find in my communication work, we're looking at the interaction as a unit of analysis. When I'm coaching, I'm looking at this person as the unit of analysis. When I'm working with teams, I'm looking at the team as a unit of analysis. When I'm looking at cultures, I'm looking as an anthropological approach to the culture as a unit of analysis. you ask different questions when you look at the different units of analysis. And most of us are just default into looking at the individuals and what do they each need. I prefer to look at the team and say, what does the team need to move forward? Next slide, please.
Those are also great interview questions.
Thank you. Interview in what way, Dana? What do you mean?
If someone's going to be playing on a team, you had brought up, turned into the interview question around, tell me your favorite, some attributes of your favorite team you've ever worked with.
Yes, that's exactly right. Get people to look at the team. That's exactly right. Thank you.
And then also
that
it could be flipped to how about a team that you worked with that you wouldn't want to work with again?
Yes. And they might say we had one of those curmudgeon people, which is so funny.
That's funny.
And in my regard, the team didn't handle that well. So it's just a different way of looking at it. All right, so one of the things that I find consistently, no matter whether it's a top team or a middle team, is what really slows teams down is their process mentality. So like I said before on the model I use, roles, goals, relationships, processes and procedures and leadership, if you can get people at a meta level, a process level, understanding what we're doing and why we're doing it, and then the steps to do it, it really helps the team. Are we decision making? Are we problem solving? Are we gathering information? Are we giving information? Are we generating ideas? And then to know the process steps that are involved in those things. In a very global way, you know, how often teams meet, what they talk about, you know, the team rhythms, those are process things as well, what's on the agenda and so forth. But then you start getting into team meetings, and all of a sudden the processes just get all jumbled. And let's just say we're trying to solve problems, and people jump right to solution sets. And I'm like, no, we have to define the problem, what it is, what it isn't. We have to come up with criteria to measure anything against, any alternative against. We need to do some technique to generate alternatives like brainstorming. And by the way, most people don't even know the rules to brainstorming. They just know the words. You know, and then after we do that, we have to narrow the alternatives down, and then we have to measure them against the criteria, and then we have to talk about implementation. Those are all process steps, you know, decision-making steps. You know, who are the real decision-makers? Who needs to be consulted before the decision? Who needs to be informed after the decision? Once you get super clear on processes, team meetings speed up. They get more inspirational. The team performance gets more effective and more efficient. There's more time to do things, more topics that can be looked at, more time for team development. And then there's a whole bunch of negative team processes as well that really drag teams down. So the idea of having a process mentality, process facilitation, I believe it's everybody's job on the team to make sure the processes are successful. But sometimes on teams that have reoccurring meetings all the time, we will assign a process facilitator, somebody who can just raise their hand at any point and go, hey, process check, we're getting off topic, or hey, process check, we're going down a rabbit hole, you know, or hey, process check, this sounds like it's a decision, why don't we just pick the decision makers and move on? So kind of understanding team processes, having people get good at the skill of process facilitation, and then kind of making sure the team processes are right for the team. In other words, the rhythms, the agenda, things like that. So many times we just take for granted that we're going to have a meeting once a week or once a month, and we're going to go through all of our projects, and we're all going to talk about stuff. And that, quite frankly, that's not all that effective. And most people don't really like those meetings. And so kind of having people focus on process and getting better at process, I find is one of the hidden keys to team performance. Most people just don't learn this or think about this. And if they can really help any team they sit on get to high performance much more quickly.
Steve, a question came in on that. Is it better to have a third party, a consultant like yourself, come in and facilitate those meetings versus having an internal person do it?
Thank you for that question as well. And you know, I am that third party, but I've also run many organizations, and I've been a senior exec several times. So I think that for the strategic planning meetings, for the yearly offsites, way better to have an outside person. If the leader of the team themselves is good at process and can wear two hats, both as a content hat and as a facilitator, then it's absolutely okay because it costs money to bring in outside people. Then there's a third option as well, and I just want to make sure I cover it because you might have intended this in the question. Many organizations have organizational development departments or learning and OD departments, and they have facilitators. So you don't need to go to an outside facilitator like me or an expert consultant. You can have an inside-outside person, somebody who comes from a different department come and who's an expert in running meetings. I always like third parties running meetings when the leader needs to be a part of the meeting, especially for strategy and planning meetings. But on the other hand, you know, you don't need it all the time, and we don't always need third parties. And I like to build that competency within the team. Many times I will suggest a team rotate leadership, thinking of leadership as a function, not as a person. Because if you're not that good in a meeting or people, you know, get distracted or they get on their phones or do whatever they do, just to say you're that kind of, you know, B player in meetings, and I'm one of those guys. I get distracted really quickly. When you have to run meetings, you're a much better meeting participant because you're tired of herding the cats. So you immediately get the visceral empathy that says, yeah, I'll be better in the meetings because I hate it when I'm running the meetings and I got people like me in the meeting. So it's a long-winded answer, but I like both outside consultants and I like leaders to lead their own meetings too. It just depends. The last point on that would be if you do bring in an expert, be sure you learn from the expert. Be sure that they're not just running your meeting, but they're also talking to you about how they're running process and why they're doing the things they're doing so that you can build that competency set within your own team. You think about a SEAL team or a SWAT team or anything like that, they don't have third parties coming in. They run themselves, but they're all very, very competent at running themselves.
Ooh, that's good. One more question came in on that. This person is in a CEO roundtable group, and they're asking, should the facilitator of the CEO roundtable group be the facilitator, or is it better to have somebody else do it?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's so funny because we have the world of YPO and EO where you are facilitating your own groups. It's called the moderator role, and that rotates every year or two. And then we have the Vistage world, where they bring in outside people to run the meetings. So I would suggest that if you're not very good at running meetings, bring in an outsider, keep that person for a while, learn from that person, and then bring that role inside and rotate that role. Because even if the person in the roundtable group, the person who gets the chance to run it this meeting or this year, even if they're not very good at it, the team will be more effective when they help the person get good at it. And also, it's a tremendous skill set to have, especially as a CEO. So I would say step in, take the job on yourself, learn how to do it well, and then rotate that role so everybody learns how to do it. And if that's just not something the team wants and you have resources, bring in third parties like me. I love running those meetings. I run those meetings for both those groups, all three of those groups all the time. So I think it's a little bit of both, but building the skill set is what's most important. And if the team is not good at it, bring in others.
And I would say if you bring Steve in, get just ready to have your seat belts on because it's going to go boom.
Yeah, well, it's something I love. Thank you for that, Dana. Okay, so let's see, did we cover all that? We did. Let's go to the next slide. All right. So on teams, you know, finding your leadership voice and framing for higher purpose and inspiring people, this is not easy. And there's two sorts of leadership development we tend to do all the time. One of them is the horizontal development where you learn all the different skill sets. You learn how to negotiate, manage conflict, lead people, all those kind of things. The other development is internal development, when you go vertical inside of yourself. What is your voice? What do you really believe in? What would you stand up and fight for? And why are we here? what's their true purpose? Making money is like breathing. You know, that's not your true purpose. You're probably trying to help people in some way or another. The companies that are just after making money, they're getting outdated very, very quickly. The new generation wants to have reason for being other than just making money. And then learning how to inspire people is different than motivating people. And you have to go inside of yourself to be inspired yourself, to overcome big obstacles and to drive people to the next level and to have them follow you because they really believe in you. That takes a lot of skill and practice. So I think that leading with purpose is the new generation and the next generation. Not just leading, but having higher purpose, going deep inside of yourself, reaching deep, finding your own inspiration, and then bringing that to the team. We all know that emotions are contagious. A boss walks in a bad mood, pretty soon everybody's in a bad mood. A boss walks in a great mood, and everybody gets to be in a great mood. So if you find yourself inspired, you will be at a very big step towards inspiring others. Next slide. Roadblocks we find, we've talked a lot about trust already. On top teams, we get this rugged individualism. You know, what gets you here won't get you there. And a lot of times people fight their way up to the top. And so when you've got rugged individualism, you are not pulling together as a team. And there's a lot of things you can do to help that, but that will often get in the way where people are just out for themselves. They believe they can do it on their own. The sitting in the team is just a pain in the butt. They do it because they have to, but they aren't really connected to the other team members in a very positive way. I used to see that all the time, and with the X generation in the workforce now, I see it less and less. And then apathy I see still quite a bit in legacy companies where people have, through attrition, gotten up to the top. They kind of dial it in. They're not working the long hours. They just take everything as if it's okay, and we'll deal with this, and this is just the next problem. So there's no real drive. There's no real motivation to break through, do better. And so I see these things, the trust, the rugged individualism, and the apathy, as things that are roadblocks to breaking teams through. And it's usually only one or two people, but they cause havoc. And the politics around rugged individualism is not good, and then the level of performance from the people with apathy is not good. And if you do have lack of trust, you've got to deal with it right away. Next slide. Words of wisdom. Hey, okay, so we're getting close to the end here whenever I put up the words of wisdom slide. Let me just check something real quick. Okay. So the words of wisdom is leadership, I think, should be taken really very seriously. You have a lot of people watching you as a leader. Many of the younger leaders I deal with have no idea that people are really paying attention to every move, every vocal inflection, what time they come to work, what time they leave, where they eat lunch, who they eat lunch with. A lot of leaders I know don't even think about things like that, but everybody else is cueing off of that. So I think thinking about leadership, thinking about your own internal destiny with leadership, thinking about what you really believe in, and taking leadership as a role very seriously. It's not just another job. It's not just one more function to do. I think leaders can make or break organizations, and their ability to take risks and break through. A lot of leaders get up to the top and just coast until things go wrong, and then they try to fix them. Some of my most effective leaders put the pressure on when things are going well. We learned this from studying coaches. One of the most interesting things I learned from studying coaches that have highly successful teams, I'm talking sports coaches, not executive coaches, is one of the beautiful words of wisdom from him was, "Steve, when my team is doing poorly, I don't say anything. They're pros. They know they're doing poorly. But man, when they are winning, I put the pressure on like crazy. They're in good moods. They're already in their high-performance zones. This is the time when they can break through. This is the time we can make a real difference." So I thought that was just so counterintuitive and lovely. So if you've got a bunch of pros working for you, they know they're not doing a good job. Being the team leader and grinding them on that is not going to be very helpful. But when they're doing really well, putting the pressure on to excel even further, that makes a huge difference. And I know it's counterintuitive. I got a big smile on my face right now because I've actually played with that a number of times, and it is so much more fun as a leader because when you start grinding people or talking to people like, what do we do wrong, how can we do better, blah, 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 nobody loves those conversations. But when you're doing great and you talk about how to transform and jump to the next level, everybody's excited, everybody's motivated, everybody's inspired. And then next one is find your inner leader. I think we've talked a little bit about that. And then the practice mentality, this is very, very important. You don't get to be a world-class athlete without practicing all the time. The difference between winning a medal in the Olympics and not winning a medal is often a hundredth of a second. So this idea of always practicing, each meeting is a practice for the next meeting. Each task is a practice for the next task. So I actually put in a quick evaluation at the end of meetings. And we don't do anything with the evaluation. We don't record it. We don't, try to put action items in place. It's simply what worked and what didn't work. By the notion of evaluation, people immediately get better. So if you think of each meeting as a practice for the next meeting, then why wouldn't you say, hey, what did we do really well in this meeting? And then just try to keep doing more of that. And what didn't we do so well? And all you got to do is call it out. You don't have to put action items in place. And then the next time you'll be better. And then the meeting after that, you'll be even better. And the meeting after that, you'll be even better. And pretty soon, the team starts revving up to high performance without anything other than just quick evaluations and a practice mentality. Plus, if you have a practice mentality, when people don't do so well and they may maybe fail or not reach their goals or get 80% of their performance, it's a really good way to coach people into getting to the next level. Without a way of bringing them down. I find that feedback, although it's very important for people, it often gets responses of defensiveness. People get closed very quickly. They shut down. They often bounce back. But if you just think about practice, 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 how do we get better? How do we always get better? What's the next step for us? And then as a coach or as the team leader, speaking in those terms, I think the team just revs up naturally. One of my favorite things to do is to listen to coaches after the game, after they won or lost the game. How do they talk about their team? Are they taking responsibility or are they saying it's the team's responsibility? What are they doing to motivate their teams? It's fascinating. Not that all business teams are like sports teams, but there is a pretty big overlap, and I try to learn from everything and everyone all the time. I guess that's my own practice mentality. So think about yourself. What do you do to take your team to high performance? And let me leave you with this last thing. And that is, the number one indicator of a high performance team, it's not indicator, predictor. What's the number one predictor of a high performance team? And I play with teams all the time. I ask my teams this all the time. And very few people ever get it right. They go right through the list of, the leader, trusting people, motivation, goals, communication, and they go on and on and on. None of those are the right answer. The number one predictor of a high-performance team is past experience on a high-performance team. And the reason that's so important is because if you've had past experience on a high-performance team, you know what it takes, you know what it's like, you know what it feels like. And it's up to you to bring that to this team. If you're waiting around for other people to make your team high performance, it's never going to get there. It's up to you. You know what it feels like, and you know what it takes. So if your team is operating less than high performance, your meetings aren't really good, your decision-making's not great, your overall performance isn't as good as it could be, and you're just sitting around for your team leader or somebody else to make it better, that is never going to get you there. You have to bring it. You have to call it out. You have to ask the team to step in and do something different or better. That, to me, is probably the last word of wisdom, and I think that's it. I think if we go to the next slide, it's probably open for questions. And I really appreciate your time. If there's any other questions, I would love to answer them.
Wow. Steve, that was phenomenal. We're almost at the top of the hour, so I'm not going to open up the line today. But if people have questions Can they have the information on the screen with your email and your phone number. Can they reach out to you?
Yes, okay? Of course, anytime. I would love to help you. If you can ask something specific, I'll try to get you a good answer. If there's some resources you need, I will try to get you those. Please be patient. I'm awfully busy, but I do love helping people. It's just in my soul to help whoever comes into my world. So if there's something I can do for you, I would love to help.
Oh, actually, before we close, two questions. Are you a qualified Vistage presenter, Steve?
You know what? I have presented to Vistage before, but I don't know what qualified means. So that probably means I'm not a qualified Vistage presenter.
I am
a certified forum facilitator for YPO, and if there's something like that for Vistage, I just don't know about it.
Okay.
But I have spoken to Vistage groups before, and I'm happy to do that again.
You're probably on the list. So the person asking the question, Marty, then just reach out to your chair and then arrange for Steve to come on in and talk to your group. Steve's local, so that wouldn't be a problem. The last question is, Steve, of your different books, if you're going to pick one book for people to read, which book would that be, and is it available on Amazon?
Okay, this is very, very embarrassing, and I have to say none. Don't read any of them. And the reason it's embarrassing is because I haven't written anything in a fairly long time. When I wrote the Team Building Source book, it was a groundbreaking book. It went to bestseller right away, and that was probably 25 years ago. The books are written for internal facilitators. I should be writing something for everybody. I just have been so busy, I haven't had a chance. So I'm honored that you would like to read something from me. You can go to my website. I do have some blogs on there. I have some free tools. If you'd like to have a team assessment inventory, you can probably take a look at the books. I think they're on there, although we keep changing the website to update it with less and less information. So I would say take a look at the Team Building Source book. It is still available out there. But quite honestly, it is still good material, but the examples will be old. And the models in there are outstanding, and the exercises are still quite good, but it would be embarrassing if you read it because it's 25 years old and things have changed since then, and I would use much more recent examples.
Okay, so just reach out to Steve if you have questions, especially for those of you that are in different roundtable groups, if you'd like Steve to come in and speak, just talk to your facilitator and reach out to Steve. Thank you, Steve, very much for an outstanding program that you provided and information and ideas for everybody. For those of you, for our next program, which will be on August 22nd, we'll be sending out invites, and the program will be Safety is the Backbone of Every Business. Steve, it's just phenomenal. I hope you will join us again in the future because you always bring such wonderful energy and ideas that can be implemented immediately into an organization. And it's much appreciated. And big hugs from me, from everybody at Lighthouse, and especially from me.
Thank you, Dana. I really appreciate being here. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope it was helpful. And I got to tell everybody, and this is a shameless plug, Dana, we love your tools and techniques. We use them all the time. Thank you so much for bringing those to the world, and thank you for being you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks, everybody, for joining, and we'll all be talking soon. Thanks again. Have a great rest of the day. Bye-bye.